Today is Tuesday, January 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Despite growing tensions, some U.S. analysts say a conflict with Russia is not imminent.
I think there's still the possibility to find an off-ramp, no matter how distant that possibility might seem sometimes.
A new COVID vaccine is coming into play that's cheap and easy to refrigerate.
So when you start going down the checklist, this checks all the boxes for what you need for a global health vaccine.
And the last day of talks between the Taliban and Western diplomats kicks off in Oslo. We'll have these stories and more next. Ukraine's leaders are seeking to reassure the nation that a feared invasion from Russia is not imminent. The remarks come even as they acknowledge the threat is real and prepare to accept a shipment of American military equipment Tuesday to shore up their defenses. Washington has put about 8,500 troops on heightened alert for possible deployment to Europe. It's also evacuating some embassy personnel from Ukraine amid the rising tensions between Russia and NATO countries over Russia's continued mobilization of troops near the Ukrainian border. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
Tensions are heating up along Ukraine's frozen border as Russia moves more troops into position. On Monday, Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered military vehicles to Belarus's southern border for joint drills next month, putting them within 75 kilometers of Ukraine's capital. The Biden administration stands ready to respond alongside its NATO partners, says Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
While we can't get into the mind of President Putin, we are seeing the preparations that they're making at the border. We have been very clear, and the president has been direct, that military action by Russia could come at any time. He said that last week as well. So we have been in conversations and discussions with eastern flank countries.
American reactions include alerting 8,500 troops to possible deployment to other NATO countries and evacuations of some staff at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. U.S. President Joe Biden has not spoken on the matter in several days, ignoring questions shouted his way on Monday. Later in the day, he held a call with top European, EU, and NATO leadership, in which the parties emphasized their wish for a diplomatic resolution and discussed their preparations to impose massive consequences and severe economic costs on Russia for such actions, as well as to reinforce security on NATO's eastern flank. Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces are readying for an invasion and questioning the diplomatic process between the U.S. and Russia.
It's wrong when two countries discuss a future of another country. We also should take part in those talks.
Russia watchers say Russia is trying to negotiate Ukraine's future without involving Ukraine, which hasn't been present in many of the high-level talks. But analysts don't think conflict is inevitable, partly because of the diplomatic efforts led largely by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Andrew Lawson, a fellow in the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, via Zoom.
You know, this is still a confrontation that hasn't yet spilled over into open conflict. I think there's still the possibility to find an off-ramp, no matter how distant that possibility might seem sometimes. The fact is, we're still talking.
Blinken's Russian counterpart said last week that Moscow did not expect a breakthrough from the latest round of talks, but wanted a written response to its proposals, which included that NATO reduce some of its presence in Eastern Europe and bar Ukraine from entry to the security alliance. Some Russia analysts say Putin is playing a long game. Leon Aron, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, via Zoom.
Putin is a judo enthusiast. And in judo, you very rarely win. Contrary to the stereotype, you very rarely win by a throw. You win by the accumulation of points. There is no knockout. He hasn't won. But look, he probed NATO, right? He tested it. And NATO showed a great deal of wobbling and disjoint, right? Every time he does something or says something, the American president rushes to respond or call, or schedule a summit. And there's so many other points that accumulated this way. There's no doubt that he's winning.
Meanwhile, at the Russia-Ukraine border, the wheels of war are turning. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Counsel on Foreign Relations Russia expert Tom Graham tells me the very real possibility of sending U.S. troops into Eastern Europe means all parties are taking the situation quite seriously.
Sending troops into Central East Europe is a way for First of all, to reassure our most vulnerable allies, the Poles and the Balts in particular, that NATO has their backs, that the Article 5 guarantees of collective defense, collective security, indeed hold, and the United States will be in the lead in defending those our NATO allies should a conflict in Ukraine break out. But more important than that, should a conflict in Ukraine threaten to spread beyond the confines of Ukraine into Eastern Europe.
If you had to guess, do you think that troops really will be sent? And of course, they won't be sent to Ukraine itself, but do you think that they will be sent to Eastern Europe?
I think it's quite likely that they will be sent eventually. Other NATO countries are also moving in this direction. It's an important, I think, element of the overall administration's strategy to put Russia in a position where it's prepared to negotiate more seriously on the questions about Ukraine or more, the broader questions of European security. I mean, in a sense, what the United States is trying to do is sort of level the playing field. Russia clearly has lots of troops in the region that continue to menace Ukraine. We want to indicate that we can put troops into the region as well. And by doing that and by suggesting that, sending to the Russians the message that let's sit down, we need to talk, but this is not going to be a one-sided negotiation. We need to reach reciprocal agreements on how we're going to move forward.
And you think that if that scenario plays out, Russia will listen and the negotiations will change, the tenor of the negotiations will change?
Well, it's difficult to say at this point. We are in a negotiating process at this point. The United States has promised written responses to Russia's demands sometime this week. The Secretary of State and his counterpart, the Russian Foreign Minister, are supposed to have one further meeting once the Russians have a chance to assess our responses. There's some talk about a possible virtual summit between the presidents, President Biden and President Putin, depending on how things turn out in the lower level negotiations. So, you know, any sort of situation like this is a combination of deterrence and diplomacy. We are working on the deterrence side, but we're trying to do it in a way that facilitates further negotiations and further negotiations in a framework and in a format that is more advantageous to our interests.
So we're going to keep on talking, but we're doing it with some muscle.
That's right. And anyone will tell you that diplomacy goes much better when there's some muscle lurking in the background. This is a factor that Putin has exploited quite effectively over the past several months. The number of troops along the Ukrainian border was a major reason why the United States initially agreed to sit down and talk to the Russians back in January. The continuing threat of a possible incursion against Ukraine is a reason that the Secretary of State met with his foreign minister counterpart last week. So diplomacy, deterrence, military force, and politics go together. We shouldn't think of those as two separate things. They can be mutually reinforcing. All that said, my impression from conversations I've had in Moscow, from conversations I've had with people in Washington, that both sides prefer a diplomatic resolution of this problem, but clearly they're trying to set the stage so that whatever diplomatic resolution there is tilts more in favor of their interests.
That was Tom Graham, a Russian expert with the Council on Foreign Relations in the U.S. He was speaking to me on Tuesday. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby said Monday U.S. deployments would only happen if NATO activates a rapid response force and emphasized that no troops were intended to be deployed in Ukraine itself since it's not a NATO member. VOA's Mike Hove spoke to Dr. Angela Stent, a senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, about that scenario.
So what Putin is trying to do is to get NATO and the United States particularly to accept the fact that Ukraine should never join NATO and that Russia should have special rights in Ukraine and the neighboring countries. He really wants to get a Western recognition of that, and he wants them to back off from supporting Ukraine in a NATO membership drive, although that's not on the table, by the way, at the moment. But, you know, it's an open door policy. So that's the bottom line of what he wants.
President Biden and other NATO member states have promised the Kremlin that if Putin were to go ahead and invade Ukraine, there will be drastic measures. If this were to happen, how would this impact the eastern region of Europe?
So I think what they've said to the Russians is that if there's a military incursion by Russia, there's going to be a tough response. They haven't said there's going to be war. What they've said is there'll be very massive sanctions against Russia, which would involve really cutting Russian banks off the international payment system and things like that. But they've said that they will continue to arm Ukraine, and the Biden administration is now sending more military equipment and trainers to arm Ukraine. But they've said explicitly that American troops themselves would not get involved in any conflict with Russia, because with the two nuclear superpowers, that could be a catastrophe.
Now, I'm a little more curious in terms of the impact beyond just the eastern region of Europe. Considering the fact that both Russia and the United States have a lot of global influence, if something were to happen in Ukraine, how could this impact in terms of relations that both countries have with other regions of the world?
So for Russia, the major partner is China now. And the Chinese have so far been kind of neutral in what's going on. The Chinese themselves have a flourishing economic relationship with Ukraine. But they've just said that everything has to be settled peacefully. And they've said that Russia has a right to security guarantees. So my guess is that if this happens, the Chinese, they're not going to abandon the Russians. But I think they'll be careful because, you know, they have relations, economic relations with all of these countries in Russia's region. I think a number of countries in the world will not be happy with this. If Russia can just march into another country and maybe take some more territory, that doesn't really bode well for the rest of the world. And the Russians have said that one of the things they might do if they can't reach an accommodation with the U.S. is to send military equipment to Cuba and to Venezuela. Obviously, that's not something that the U.S. would like.
Right. Now, in closing here, Professor, a couple of days ago, we saw U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to discuss the matter at hand, to which they both highlighted that they don't expect a breakthrough from some of these negotiations. Considering the fact that these talks are ongoing, do you think that there's a possibility of anything positive coming up?
So, I mean, it's quite possible. The Russians are now waiting for written responses from the U.S. to some of their demands. Of course, a diplomatic path is possible. It might be possible to discuss things that do affect Russian security without conceding, saying that NATO will tell Ukraine that it can never join. I think it's possible. I hope it's possible. But right now, not knowing whether it's going to work out, the U.S. also has to be prepared for the fact that there could be some form of a war there.
That was Dr. Angela Stent, a senior non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. She was speaking with my colleague, Mike Hove. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain looks at how Russia has repeatedly used the word hysteria to describe U.S. and NATO reaction to its military buildup along the Ukraine border.
Of course, one would ask themselves, why have they stationed so many troops along the border? And, you know, is it intimidation or what exactly are they doing? And then Secretary Blinken actually said to Lavrov on Friday, he said, look, if you're worried about, NATO presence in Eastern Europe, what your actions are actually really being counterproductive because you are only making NATO countries and Baltic countries more worried, and you're only increasing NATO's resolve to beef up its security, and you're only uniting Ukrainians who say that they are ready to fight for their homeland. So Blinken was suggesting to Russia that these steps, you know, this huge, massive military buildup is counterproductive to your stated goals.
And so I guess the idea here is the Russian aggression is all happening because Putin is not getting what he wants, which is an ironclad statement that, you know, there will be no further expansion of NATO in Eastern Europe.
Right, exactly. At least that is what Putin has stated, you know, that he wants a promise that there will not be an expansion. But of course, it's hard to know exactly what his real goals are and what kind of concessions that he is trying to get from the West.
That was VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain speaking with me Monday in Washington. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has condemned the military seizure of power in Burkina Faso and is calling for a swift return to civilian rule there. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The High Commissioner is calling on the coup leaders to immediately release President Rochemark Christian Kabore and other high-level officials. Michelle Bachelet is urging the military to engage in meaningful dialogue with all sectors of society to restore the hard-won democratic gains that have been made in the country. Bachelet's spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, accompanied the High Commissioner on her visit to Burkina Faso at the end of November. She says there were evident signs of popular discontent with the government's inability to handle the multifaceted crises facing the country.
You had climate change affecting the ability of herders and pastoralists to carry out their you know, daily work, and conflict as a result of climate change and that crisis. And then you've got violent extremist groups attacking, coming through the porous borders of the country, and launching increasingly violent attacks against the local population.
Burkina Faso is also facing a humanitarian crisis. The United Nations estimates 3.5 million people need international aid to survive. It says nearly all, some 3.3 million people, are facing acute food shortages. Shamdasani says UN monitors on the ground describe the situation as calm for now, but this may change during planned street protests.
There are people protesting in support of the military coup as well, those who were frustrated with what they perceived as ineffective measures taken to address the conflict. But again, we stress that military takeover is not the solution.
She says it is more important than ever to ensure the rule of law and the country's obligations under international human rights law are fully respected. Shamdasani says it is crucial that people's democratic rights are protected and that they are able to air their grievances without fear. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA News. A new vaccine entered the pool of shots against COVID-19. This vaccine aims to reach low and middle income countries, where vaccine access has lagged behind that of wealthier countries. But it's not clear what role it will play in the evolving pandemic, as we hear from VOA's Steve Barragona.
The new vaccine, developed at Baylor College of Medicine, is 90% effective against the original COVID-19 coronavirus and 80% against the Delta variant. Data on Omicron is coming. The vaccine is also cheap, refrigerator-stable, and easy to manufacture in developing countries, says team co-lead Dr. Peter Hotez.
So when you start going down the checklist, this checks all the boxes for what you need for a global health vaccine.
Hotez and colleagues use the same old tried-and-true technology that they've used to develop vaccines against neglected tropical diseases, those that Big Pharma is less inclined to treat, because that's what's most available to vaccine makers in low- and middle-income countries, he says.
That's why I was so disheartened at the beginning of the pandemic when everyone was focusing on new technologies. I knew that would be a barrier to access.
Wealthier nations poured money into making new technology vaccines. Now about 80% of people in upper-income countries have been vaccinated, but only about 10% in low-income countries have. And Hotez and colleagues are making the vaccine available without patents. He says intellectual property rights just get in the way during a global crisis.
If your house is on fire and you can only have time to make one phone call, you don't call a patent attorney, you call the fire department, and we're the fire department.
The Indian government recently authorized the vaccine, and Indian company Biological E is making hundreds of millions of doses a month under the name Corbevax. Companies in Indonesia, Bangladesh, and Botswana are planning production too. But it's not clear whether Corbevax will hold up as well as the new technology vaccines against the Omicron variant, says Johns Hopkins University vaccine expert Dr. William Moss.
The Sinopharm, Sinovac vaccines, those are an older technology. They are not doing well against Omicron. Very much reduced vaccine effectiveness.
Global supplies of other vaccines are improving. The United Nations-backed COVAX program recently delivered its 1 billionth dose. Big drug makers are promising billions more doses this year. And other new vaccines are entering the market. But if it holds up against variants, a low-cost vaccine like Corbevax will still be useful, because COVID-19 will be with us for years to come, Moss says.
We'll be kind of transitioning into this kind of endemic mode and more routine vaccination, and that's where these vaccines may play a role.
Experts say a regular shot against multiple COVID-19 strains could be in everyone's future. The less it costs, the better. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
An expert panel is advising the Israeli government to begin offering a fourth vaccine dose to everyone over the age of 18. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
The advisory committee says research shows a fourth dose provides 3 to 5 times the level of protection against serious disease and double the protection against infection compared to 3 doses. The health ministry's director must approve the recommendation, though. Israel's already offering a second booster to everyone over the age of 60 and those at high risk. It began offering third doses to the general population last summer. There are currently some 580,000 active patients in Israel, with just 845 listed as seriously ill. I'm Charles de la Desma.
South Sudan recently held a Peace Olympics to help reconcile communities divided by conflict. The Twitch Olympics this year marked its 20th anniversary, as Sheila Pony reports from Twitch County in South Sudan.
At this Olympics opening ceremony, a spiritual leader blesses athletes to protect them from injury, while a goat represents the belief that power comes from nature. This is not the Winter Olympics in Beijing. It's the Twitch Olympics in northern South Sudan. The annual 2 weeks of games in January attracts athletes from 6 communities to compete in traditional Olympic and team sports. The aim, to reduce communal conflict. Volleyball player Ring Agok Ring knows violence firsthand.
It was in 2021.
In May, they came to raid our cattle, and in the process of protecting them, I was shot. 2 bullets are now with me. And at last, I succeeded to get my cows back. As I'm still now in the games, I'm an injured person through cattle raiding. I still can play because I'm seeing it as a unifying factor.
Char comes.
More than 700 athletes participated this year's 20th anniversary games, which also promotes health issues such as preventing COVID, HIV, and waterborne diseases. Twitch Olympics founder Achuil Bangol says the games have a mission.
Peace does not come without agenda. You cannot tell people to remain peaceful without them being active on something that is keeping them away from bad activities. You're building another avenue of communicating and interacting with youth.
South Sudan is the world's youngest country at 11 years of independence, but it has never been fully at peace. Twitch Olympics Association Secretary Chol Ajing says involving youth in the games can help end conflicts.
South Sudan, the crisis of 2013 and 16 was fueled up because the young people responded. And what about if young people get engaged in activities like this and do not think about joining the politicians and fuel the war?
These South Sudanese athletes prefer tug of war and are urging those still fighting real battles to drop their weapons and join them in the glory of sports. Sheila Aponi, for VOA News, Twitch, Mayardit County.
8 people were killed outside a soccer game in Cameroon at the Africa Cup of Nations. Officials in Yaoundé say more than 35 people were injured in the Cameroonian capital. Crowds on Monday attempted to enter the Yaoundé Olembi Stadium, which has a capacity of 60,000, to watch the host nation beat Comoros 2-1 in Africa's top football tournament. The last day of talks between the Taliban and Western diplomats has begun in Oslo with a bilateral meeting with Norwegian government officials. The 3-day talks opened on Sunday with talks between the Taliban and members of Afghan civil society, followed on Monday by multilateral talks with Western diplomats, the EU, the US, Britain, France, Italy, and hosts Norway. The closed-door meetings are expected to range from education to humanitarian aid. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of managing editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, we're glad you could join us today. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.